So the report is broken down into four sections. The first part is a historical and legislative analysis to situate and contextualize where we are today on the child soldiers phenomenon, which is why it was very important for us to have the child soldiers, the Romeo Dallari Child Soldiers Initiative on board as well. What we found in our historical analysis was that although the use of children by the Islamic State is very shocking, it is unfortunately not new. The systematic use of children has, of course, been echoed in African countries. It was echoed by Hitler youth groups, and the component where the use of children by Islamic State has the most similarity is that with the Ba'athist regime. And so that was the historical contextualization. The legislative analysis was also very important, because through doing that and through understanding what international legal frameworks are in place for returning child soldiers, we were able to find that there is a very strong international legislation on territorial responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So in Britain, for example, we have up to 50 British children in Islamic State. Children are classified as anyone below the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
So of these 50 children, should any of them choose to escape and return to the United Kingdom has a responsibility to reintegrate them, and to, you know, they have a responsibility towards them. Now, linking the two, the DDR programs, the de-radicalization programs in place already are all very specific to African contexts.
Okay.
So that's why we wanted to then look at what children are used for, how they're recruited, their roles in the Islamic State. And the way that we did that is through a six-month period up to February 2016 this year, we collected and collated and translated and analyzed all pieces of propaganda released by the Islamic State relating to children. And we found 254 pieces of this propaganda.
Okay.
And what we found was the majority of this propaganda relates to violence, either children committing acts of violence or being normalized to violence, so watching violence happen, watching beheadings, watching videos. And so because of their cognitive frameworks, their lack of adult experiences, the sense of morality breaks down, violence becomes the norm, and the educational curriculum is also very biased, because we were able to get a look at some of the textbooks, some of the announcements by Islamic State regarding education. We could see that things like history classes, for example, situate the Islamic State above all other countries. They reduce the legitimacy, and they warrant hatred towards other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so as a result, you have children being severely disturbed and mentally traumatized and physically abused in the context of the Islamic State. And what was interesting was also the role of families in this. In regimes such as Saddam Hussein and Hitler, children were used primarily as spies to spy on the family and then inform the leaders what the families think of the regime. What we're seeing here is a flip of that. Families are part of the radicalization process. They're the ones who are often taking children from foreign countries or giving birth to children in foreign countries. So it becomes a full spectrum of agents involved in training these children. And the scale of the problem is also very important. We have figures that there are 31,000 women pregnant in Islamic State. There are many, many children being affected by the crisis in the thousands. So you have a new generation of fighters who are whose sense of morality is being broken down, who are so normalized to violence, which led us to the final part of the report, which is policy, because while it's very important to do this research, we need to be more proactive in our approach and set up a network of countries who are able to respond to this problem, which is inevitable as it's happening right now. And that was when we had UNESCO's reading of it and endorsement of the report. The findings were also run past the UN Commission for Children in Armed Conflict. And so the findings and the policy recommendations we've put through are not just for a United Kingdom or an EU-wide perspective, but really this is an international problem, and so it requires an international response, and it also requires a network of actors. Just as they are employing a network of actors to indoctrinate and educate the child, we similarly need a network of actors to re-educate and de-radicalize these children.
Okay, and in terms of how you've compiled this report, you mentioned
Yeah.
that you'd studied propaganda.
Yes.
Are there question marks over the reliability of the report as a result of that, or are you happy with?
Absolutely. That's a very good question. And as researchers, it's important to know the shortcomings of primary source material. Of course, this material is very biased. There are instances of children speaking to the camera who looking very happy. We don't know to what extent these children have been forced to say these things, to what extent they have any agency at all, or that they even know what they're saying. So that's very biased. Other elements of bias are how do you recognize who's a child or not? Sometimes we had to rule out a lot of so-called children because of facial hair or because they're in that cusp where you don't really know if they're above 18 or below. Similarly, there are children in running around in the background of a beheading, for example, and we would have to then judge whether that counts as a normalization to violence or not. So there, of course, I completely agree, there are shortcomings to primary source material, but there are shortcomings to primary source material in any form of research, whether it's archival analysis, and the fact that this propaganda has been released by Islamic State means that they want us to see it. But it does give us an impact, an insight into what life is like, even though that insight might be biased towards the people who are releasing that information.
Okay, brilliant. You touched on the historical context at the start, in terms of
Yes.
Hitler, in terms of Liberia, I think.
Yes.
How does this rate in terms of the historical context? Do you think it's the worst we've ever seen, or?
Well, I think in terms of how it rates, what I was saying earlier is that it really builds, and that's inevitable because new movements will always build on old movements. The streams that we found most similar were, of course, of Saddam Hussein and youth movements employed by him for his cubs and his soldiers. Yes, there are elements of style, for example, things like uniforms. Uniforms are very important. Segregation of boys and girls, different education and for gendered education, and most interestingly, education in terms of what is in the best interest for the nation, and not so much what is in the best interest for the child. So, for example, with girls, girls are mostly given an educational curriculum of medicine because they are allowed to be doctors because obviously, this is a war effort too, and there will be soldiers who will require medical care. But girls are not allowed to study much else. And so you have a very strong nation state, an authoritarian nation state, deciding about the next generation of children, not so much children deciding what they want for themselves and out of their lives. And so, yes, there are many, many echoes of many authoritarian states. What is I would say most worrying about this is the element of violence, extreme violence, and the younger ages of children involved, and the role of the family and the role of the mothers in participating in this as well.
What's the youngest child you've seen involved in something like an execution?
So the youngest child, if you followed the story of Siddhartha Dhar, who converted and went from the United Kingdom, he was holding a newborn in a photo with one hand and a gun in the other. And so I would say that would be the youngest child I've seen, probably not participating, but being used in propaganda to show the next generation will be as violent or more violent than the current one.
Okay, and how many children, how many child soldiers do we have in ISIL at the moment? Do we know?
I can't answer that question because again, it's very difficult to identify children. I don't want to give you an inaccurate number, but I do know that 5,000 children, according to the United Nations, 5,000 children have been affected by the war in Syria. But that is also not answering your question. But That's the only statistic that I
That's
know.
not necessarily Islamic State, is it?
Exactly, and
Okay.
affected could mean anything. Mentally affected, physically affected. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're participating in
Sure.
war.
And you said that 50 children from the UK were involved. Do
Yeah.
we have any figures for the rest of Europe or elsewhere? Or is it just the UK you've
We
concentrated?
really don't. We really don't have more figures, and
Okay.
the issue is because this problem is so new. So I'll just draw a parallel example with women. As women started to increasingly go to Islamic State, the interest increased in how and the numbers of women, and that was when we started to have real figures from different countries. While that interest might be there for children now, it's just so difficult to keep track of because of the number of children who are being born there. And so that is one of our policy recommendations, that there is a need to build some kind of research on this, which simply has not been done so far, and I'm not even sure if it is possible because of our lack of access to try to understand what life really like is ha what is really happening out there. Because as I mentioned earlier, even propaganda, which is our closest way to understand the kind of educational curriculum, the role of child soldiers, how they're recruited, etc., which is what we tried to do in the report, as I mentioned to you, is of course biased because the people who are releasing it are them. So we're seeing what they want us to see.
Yes. Okay. You also mentioned in the report about 31,000 pregnant women
Yes.
within the area controlled by ISIL.
Yes.
Can we get an idea of how many of these are likely to be child soldiers? I mean, are these women all under the control or under the control of ISIL, or are they just living there, or?
Yeah, I would argue that the 31,000 we quoted, all of them would be trained, because this figure, while it is astoundingly high, we have to keep in mind that many of these women are second and third wives. They are sex slaves. They have been kidnapped and abducted, and so they are being impregnated for the sole reason of bringing up their children as in these educational curriculums and as the next generation of fighters. So I would say that all of those children are going to be educated in the curriculum that we've researched, and yeah.
That's quite a shocking number.
Yes, it's shockingly high. I agree. But it's what our president Noman Benotman has found in his research and his fieldwork during his time his last year in the Middle East. So
Although I guess
so
that's
yes,
not to say that they're all going to turn out to be child soldiers, but they're going to, like you say, be indoctrinated from a.
indoctrinated. Absolutely. So even with our policy, the policy recommendations that we were trying to set about, it was very difficult to categorize children. First, it of course is the age of the child, but as important is the level of indoctrination. Has it been mostly educational indoctrination, so that would require re-education, or is it educational indoctrination coupled with the child committing acts of violence, in which case you would need a re-education, and also you would need therapy, you would need PTSD therapy, and you would need a theological re-education as well. And so that's why this network of actors that we want to facilitate for the re-education and reintegration of children, should they escape and return, would have to be so nuanced. It would have to be on a child case-by-case basis, because all of these children are victims. Even I would argue, even the older ones, the 14 or 15-year-old girls who have gone from the United Kingdom, for example, are to some extent victims, because they simply don't have the cognitive development and maturity of an adult. And so in some way they have been educated in a certain way by a mentor, whether it's a mentor of their own age, a child of their own age, so it becomes a peer peer effort, or if it's someone they look up to, so a teacher or a mother or father, for example, telling them that this is right and this is wrong. And that's something that we will have to eventually deal with, and something that we haven't even thought of as yet, because most of our policy so far has been very reactive rather than proactive. And to criticize our own report, even our policy recommendations, while they are proactive in dealing with this issue, they're still reacting to children who have already been severely indoctrinated and gone through this. So yes, that is an issue that we'll have to deal with.
There's lots of disturbing parts in this report. I mean, what was the most shocking finding that you found in terms of children, child soldiers and ISIL?
The most shocking finding, I think the sheer scale of violence was very shocking. Because going through all of these events, I'll be honest, I was hoping that there would be more education codified events, so there would be more children in schools, and because at least they're learning something. But what it seems to be le that they're learning is the violence is so it's so deep in everything, including the educational curriculum. For example, textbooks will have pictures of guns, and the guns will be used to do counting, and pictures of tanks. And so, and this is in a primary school book. And so, just the level of violence, the normalization of violence, was very shocking to me, because it's something you simply don't associate with young children. School, for example, should be a place where children are made to feel happy and safe, not a place where they're exposed to such brutal and such violent things. So I think that was the most shocking aspect of the report for me personally.
What's the impact, do you think, of indoctrinating at such a young age?
Well, it is the impact is threefold. So it's a primary, secondary, and a tertiary. It's a third impact. The primary impact is the child themselves can commit acts of violence. The secondary impact is that the child can convince the family to commit acts of violence, or that the fa it becomes a mutually reinforcing effect, that the child convinces the family, and the family will convince the child that this violence is normal, and this state is Islamic State is superior, etc. And then the third impact you have is a future impact, because obviously these children will grow up to be adults, they will grow up to be adult fighters. And so, of course, I would say that the impact is threefold, and it's based on these factors.
And I guess the military effort over there at the moment, is there the case to say that, it should be speeded up? Because it seems the longer that ISIL exist and have this way of indoctrinating children, it kind of strengthens them the longer it goes on, does it not?
Well, I wouldn't say it was as straightforward as that, because unfortunately, a lot of the propaganda we found also fed into something we call foreign policy grievance, and those are children who have been hurt or who are dying, who are videotaped, and then that propaganda is released to then say that, look at what the West is doing to the Islamic State. They're killing children in Syria and Iraq, and that kind of fuels the whole West versus Islamic State divide, which is their key foreign policy grievance. So, increasing the boots on the ground and increasing drones is a very short-term solution to a long-term problem. Yes, we require military strength by all means, but we also will eventually need much softer approaches to do with DDR and re-education and de-radicalization of children. And so a significant amount of nations' budgets will also have to go on these softer long-term approaches.
Lots of the report does talk about reintegration. How much of a challenge is it, and do you think it's realistic that this is ever gonna happen?
I won't lie, it is a huge challenge to reintegrate children, and the reason we have a whole section on DDR from other countries, including Afghanistan and Pakistan, is to show the just the level of violence that these children have had to deal with, and so to reintegrate them is hard enough when traditionally you have families who they have been abducted from. So the child would be abducted from the family and then returned, and so you had at least a support system that the child was familiar with to take care of the child once they return. I can't even imagine how difficult it's going to be when the family is part of the radicalization process and the child is then separated not only from the family but the education system that they've been taught, the propaganda that they've been taught, plus the mental and physical and emotional trauma that they're suffering. So it will be incredibly difficult to reintegrate children. And so there is that need for not only foster care workers, support workers, grassroots workers, therapists, possibly even the police to be involved if the child is a danger to themselves or to other children. All of these factors will have to be combined together to have a full spectrum response to these children, and so it will definitely not be easy. And that's why we have to start talking and discussing this issue as soon as possible now, because it's only going to get more difficult the longer we leave it.
Do you think it's realistic that they're ever going to come back, though?
I think it is. I mean, we had an example a few weeks ago. Tarina Shako from the Islamic State came back to the United Kingdom and said that she had made a mistake. She traveled with her son, who was very young, and so I think what happened in that case was he would have been referred to channel and re and or maybe even not because he was so young, and then reintegrated with his extended family here. And we were very lucky in that case because the child in question was very young. In other cases where children will want to escape or will perhaps not escape to the United Kingdom directly but might escape to neighboring countries' refugee camps and then say, actually, I'm British or I'm French and I want to go back. I mean, seeing the sheer scale of children involved means that it is very, very likely that they will that we will have more cases of children returning, either with their families, as was the case with Tarina Shako, that one family member realizes they made a mistake and are disillusioned with what they found in the Islamic State and want to come back, or if a sense of their own agency if they get older, wanting to escape. And so I think it is realistic, and I think with the sheer level of numbers, it is likely to happen very soon.
And is the UK government powerless to stop the children coming into the country?
Well, I don't want to speak on behalf of the UK government because I don't work for them, but I think what we found in terms of legislation is that should a British child, choose to return, then they have an obligation to take them in. Well, that doesn't mean that they will immediately go to re-education, and that's on page 70, I think 72 of our report. There are phases which a child will go through depending on their degree of radicalization. If the child is, but we want to keep in mind that children below the age of 18 are victims, so they will go through a very different process from what an adult like Tarina Shako would go through if they choose to return.
Okay. Nikita Malik from the Quilliam Foundation. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for taking the
Great.
time to chat to me.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking to me. All right.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye.